It's Dr. Steve. Dr. Steve Salzman joining us, Green Care Medical, on this Monday. How you doing, Dr. Steve?
Okay. How is everybody?
Good. You know, okay. Pretty good. We have some kind of a heavier things to talk about, and they're not exactly just the latest in what's going on with COVID, but they are sort of the related issues that are, I think, worthy of a lot of attention. And, you know, you brought this up to me last week right after you were on the show, and you said, you know what, I think it's time we kind of address sort of the mental aspects of dealing with what's going on in the world and these stressful times and the kinds of things that people are feeling. And I was like, great, let's do it. And I know that you are, you've done a lot of research yourself in this area, and you deal with patients who are going through this a lot too. So, you know, anything can be helpful at a time like this. And I'd love to hear your thoughts, Dr. Steve, to help us and the people that are in our lives that we might want to reach out to and help them too.
Right. Mental health touches everybody in this world, knows somebody who struggles with some form of mental illness. This was an emerging crisis before COVID even happened. You know, COVID came at a time where they were already struggling, people were struggling to get mental health care, the cost of it, the lack of access, the shortage of providers. It was already a problem, and we talked about it several months ago. A Kaiser Family Foundation poll came out, and they said 56% reported worry or stress related to an outbreak that's led to at least one negative mental health effect. And among frontline healthcare workers, that number was 64%. That had some kind of worsened mental health. And by the way, I would argue that is probably very low and much higher. Isolation, grief, and also the trifecta, economic hardship, all, you know, when you mix them together are creating this mental health crisis, or let's call it a worsening. Several months ago, they had a non-peer-reviewed paper come out, and they basically claimed that over the next decade, as many as 75,000 additional people could die as a result of suicide or substance abuse-related deaths. And the suicide rate in the United States has been rising for the last two decades. So it was already a huge problem. In 2018, it hit its highest level since 1941. And while social isolation protects from contagious virus, you know, it puts people at risk for suicide, overdoses, alcohol abuse, which we talked about last week, and employment matters, because when you have economic livelihood and mixed with a mental and emotional health, there's a potential, you know, it's everything on a collision course and conspiring together. So it's very, very important that we understand that this problem is massive. And health fears, job losses, relationship strains, lonely days spent in isolation, these are all things that have sort of made this problem for many people 100 times worse. Hell, just in our place alone, at our clinic, anxiety, insomnia, and depression have long been known to be sort of that trifecta of things we see from patients, regardless of what was wrong with them. Even back pain, even cancer, even ALS. It was very interesting to find that much of the things that we were finding that were crippling people were mental health related to one degree or another. And again, intense stressors like job loss, fears for your health and your well-being, this all contributes to this stuff, and it's a huge problem. And, you know, how do you combat it is the million-dollar question. Obviously, we have to address unemployment. You have to make it easier to access mental health care. And probably at some point there's going to have to be some kind of integration of mental health care more robustly into primary care services that are given out by our internists and our physicians. Because all of these things sort of go together, and there's a formula I believe in, Anna, and I preach it and we're publishing on it. Phase one is sleep. You got to get patients sleeping 6 to 7 hours a night. When people sleep, you reset their biorhythms, circadian rhythms, all the thinking centers of the brain. You keep stress hormones under check. It is the absolute first thing that has to happen. And then following that It's the other stuff that we start talking about, getting people symptoms controlled, and this is where people sort of get into a problem and what we deal with, and we're going to talk about it after the break about the opiate crisis and how this is also, everything is sort of intimately linked together, and one problem sets off a chain reaction of many other problems.
You know, it's for those who have, of us who have someone in our family who has dealt with depression for a while. I find just personally that the isolation has been, it augments the issues that much more. And you hear about that a lot. You read that these are even more difficult times for people who went into this dealing with some sort of issue like that. Depression, the isolation, as you point out, is not necessarily a good thing. Good for the virus, not good for emotional health. But I also wonder about people who haven't really sort of been stressed like this in a long time or dealt with it in this way. What are some of the early signs, Doc, that you would say, you know, kind of just point in the direction of say, you know what, you might need to sort of do something about that. You know, I'm seeing some signs here that you're struggling a little bit.
The overt signs are easy. People who have change in behavior, who isolate, who have overwhelming anxiety or panic issues, who start having sort of erratic or errant behavior, or many times with family members, they'll know that, you know, this is, I've seen this before with, especially with major depressive disorder and bipolar, they've seen that behavior before, and the triggers go. So a lot of times it's overt. The difficulty is in the ones that aren't. And these are the ones that are terrifying. And, you know, I know, they know to let the audience in, I just lost a friend and a team member to suicide. And it's a very difficult situation. And a lot of times there are no warning signs. And it is absolutely terrifying because people seem to be doing fine. They're not exhibiting any of the things I just talked about, but they're deeply suffering. And how do you get through to those people? I don't, that could be very, very difficult, but that's why it's very important that we check in with our loved ones and that we talk to people we care about and ask difficult questions and have difficult conversations, because this is a difficult topic and many people see this as a weakness. Hell, like in the 1980s and 90s, if you took an antidepressant, oh my God, you're crazy. You know, I mean, the stigma was just hearing the word, I'm on an antidepressant. Now, you know, it's the exact opposite. It's like, what, you're crazy if you're not on an antidepressant, right? The shifts, the paradigm shifts are huge. And, you know, that's the problem. You know, it's not cut and dry, but certainly this is a time that we all have to be sort of vigilant, not only about our physical health, but our mental health, eating and sleeping well, staying socially connected, limiting news and social media, all of these things that can potentially trigger a worsening of mental health symptoms, we have to try to either step away from it or shield ourselves to some degree from it. Because the other side of the mental health crisis, when it grips people, it takes them out both, you know, physically as well as mentally and emotionally.
And recognize it in the people around us, too, I think, because sometimes, you know, people need help. When you said team member, you just lost a team member. You're a member of the SWAT team, we should tell people. And it was a Justice Police officer, tragically, over the weekend, who had committed suicide, and I know you knew him, and I'm sorry about that, and my wishes go out to his family. My sister also knew him indirectly because his mother worked at her school. So it is, sad, you know, it's very sad. One of the things I should point out here, and before we pause for just a second here, Dr. Steve Salzman, Green Care Medical, is there are a number of resources out there, that can help folks, and it's, some of them are free, which is a great thing in times like this. The crisis text line for the state is set up for anyone in any type of crisis, 24 hours a day. You can text HELLO to 741-741. HELLO 741-741, and they have trained crisis counselors who will respond and try to help you and point you in the right direction. The other thing, the other resource just to point out here, dhs.state.il. So it's basically for the state of Illinois. There are a number of help hotlines and call centers and things with trained people on the other side. They have suicide prevention line. They have a crisis text line. There are things for kids and other stuff, too, to check out. One other thing they do have is something we're going to discuss in just a minute here, Illinois' helpline for opioids and other substances. This is a story that I just feel like in all other times when all of this were not going on, this would be a major talking point, a major point of discussion, because the opioid crisis, already something we've talked about for some time, is, it's not, the trend line is not good. More than twice as many people have died or are suspected to have died of opioid overdoses in the first 5 months of the year in Cook County. So the numbers are way up. Want to talk about that too, and how you help folks who are dealing with that. Dr. Steve Salzman, Green Care Medical, is on with us. Some important information. We've been talking about dealing with stress and anxiety and depression and all that kind of stuff in these times, some of the available resources, how to recognize it if it's you or someone around you who is dealing with it. It's not a fun topic to talk about, but it's very relevant to these times. And it's something Dr. Salzman pointed out to me last week. He said, you know, we're hearing a lot of this. We might want to address it and not just ignore that this is going on. Quick question for you, Dr. Steve, from a listener here. Can you ask Dr. Steve, what's the proper thing to do when you're in a store wearing a mask and you have to sneeze? Do you remove the mask and sneeze in your elbow, or do you just sneeze right into that mask, which seems so kind of gross because then you're sort of living with that as you're, you know, you got the mask on for a while. Thanks so much.
Well, yeah, God. The answer is don't remove the mask. I'd probably try to maybe hold the mask, because I've actually seen people sneeze and blow the mask off a little bit. So, you know, all the secretions that are trying to be held in actually get escaped out. No, I mean, this is why we're wearing the masks. We wear the masks to protect, you know, others from our secretions, from the respiratory tract. So the answer is sneezing your mask and then deal with the possibility. Good question, though.
Yeah, so then you just got to kind of live with the secretions for a little while? Is that what
I'm hearing? Well, I mean, obviously, you probably, if you need a tissue, something different. But in terms of the actual sneeze, you want it protected, because when it gets expelled, if you took it off, the chances of it expelling forward, you know, beyond that 6 feet and stuff, increases because the mask isn't blocking anything. So just leave the mask in place.
Okay, leave it in place. And do you also go into the elbow as well with the mask on?
You know what? I would do that probably as course of habit. That's how I usually sneeze. So most people are doing that because it's muscle memory, and that's why they're doing that. But, you know, I mean, sure, I don't think that's necessary if you wear the mask. The whole point of the mask is to trap this from being expelled out into the air and around other people.
Okay. Got that messy topic out of the way. Thank you. I was wondering that myself, and when I saw a listener ask that question, I thought, yes, we have to ask you that. Because we're wearing them longer now and more, and so we're trying to sort through all this, the stuff that you folks in the medical community have dealt with for a long time.
Sneezing better than toilets.
What, sneezing's better than toilets?
Yeah, remember we do the toilet plume and stuff? I mean, it's much nicer, considering.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. The toilet plume. That seems so long ago when we were concerned about the toilet plume.
Yes, purple rain, fecal rain. That's right.
But are we worried about the toilet plume still, or is that a thing we used to be worried about and now we're not so worried about?
I mean, anytime someone flushes the toilet in public, I'm extremely worried. COVID or no COVID, you know, because I'm out of my mind. So
Great point. I kind of am too. I'm sort of a little bit weirded out by that stuff. So I got to switch gears a little bit and ask you about this too, because we've seen these numbers on the opioid use and abuse and even deaths, and they're skyrocketing in Chicago and Cook County. And this was something that had come up a lot about a year ago. It was in the news so much, and we were talking about it, and we haven't talked about it so much. I know that this is another thing that you have looked into, Dr. Steve. What can you tell us about what you're seeing there?
Opiates are ravaging this country. Before anything about COVID or anything else, it was an absolute stain on this country and continues to be a massive problem. And what hurts this? The decreased access to treatment because of the times now. There's been, you know, the opportunity for distraction from addictions like self-help groups like AA and NA, which then possibly can't meet. This is problematic things because it cuts support systems for people. And opiates are a real problem, Anna. You can't just stop them because people get dope sick. And anybody that's ever been on an opiate for even a short period of time and come off of it, it feels sometimes like you're going to die, like you have the worst flu of your life. And you have to really slowly, especially long-term opiate users, it's very dangerous. You can't just cut them off. You have to really slowly wean it. When I say slowly, I'm talking about maybe, you know, 10% of the dose, you know, over a period of time. It's not big weans. Pharmacotherapy and psychotherapy, there are many things that go into treating opiate use and opiate abuse. It's a multi-pronged approach. And add unemployment to that because you cannot, it has to be brought into it. They recently did a study that drew a direct link with opiate overdoses and upticks in unemployment. The National Bureau of Economic Research, as the country's unemployment rate increased by 1 percentage point, the opioid death rate rises by 3.6%, and the ER visit rate for opiate overdoses increases by 7%. Those are massive increases to a problem that's already festering in this country. And it's a big problem, and it's a complex issue. There's links between pain, mental health problems, use of analgesics. You know, when people have health insurance could be a problem, and or public health funding for treatment and prevention programs. There's just so many things that go into this issue. One of the things that we're doing, Anna, and that we got started with Green Care Medical, now that's LeafWell, which is we are able to treat patients of opiate addiction, transition them to cannabis first, and then go after weaning them down off of their opiates. You can't, it's not just snap your fingers or overnight the problem solved. But again, this is at least this is something that we're very sort of aggressively pursuing because marijuana, right? Patients that are on opiates can potentially die, can potentially overdose, have potential massive withdrawal symptoms. All three things which we're able to avoid, you know, with patients in cannabis, which is why it's one of the huge things that we're researching right now is the use of cannabis in many facets of mental health. And it's a big, big problem. And I think part of fixing this opiate problem is going to lie on the ability for physicians to offer other strategies and other potential products that can treat people for pain issues. But opiates, unemployment, mental health, and COVID, these are all sort of roped in to one big nuclear bomb.
Right, to all related issues. There's no doubt about it. And I'm happy you mentioned to me that we should talk about it because I think we should and continue to stay on top of it. And I know that your own experience, you're seeing patients who are dealing with these things. So thanks for addressing it with us, Dr. Steve.
Absolutely. And anybody, Anna, who wants to, interested in getting a card, they can go on the website. That's LeafWell, LeafWell.co, LeafWell.co. If somebody's interested or has that problem, reach out because, you know, potentially we have a solution. And everybody stay safe.
Thank you, Dr. Steve. Dr. Steve Salzman, good hearing from you. We'll talk to you again later this week.
Talk to you. Bye.